talk about different ministries we have for discipleship, evangelism, for mercy ministries. And I'll talk about the resources that are needed for it. But there's also space for you to give feedback on what you think or what you hope to see happen in these ministries. And at the end of this little booklet, there's space for you to make a pledge for what you think you might be able to give for the upcoming year. And then we'll collect these booklets at the end of February, and this will allow our elders and our pastors to form a budget that we think will serve us well. If you have any questions about that, please feel free to talk to David or Kyle as well. We'll be in prayer for Kyle and his wife as they return home from a much-deserved vacation in Cambridge. They will be back with us next week. Well, as we turn to our text today, I believe we have a message before us, a message that reminds us that in a world of pain, God provides direction. Desperation and pain demands direction. And the only right direction for us to turn to is to flee to the King. Well, you might have heard the phrase, there's a world of pain out there. It's true, right? There's good pain, there's bad pain, there's necessary pain, there's unnecessary pain, just pain and unjust pain. Take, for example, few of us may have made resolutions at the beginning of the year to go to the gym a little more often. And when we do, we end up putting ourselves in pain, but we're getting back in shape, and it's a good feeling. A few of us could probably use to lift a few more weights, but it's a reminder to us that it's a good pain. There's also the pain of learning a new instrument. Take, for example, the guitar. When you're learning the guitar, you build up calluses on your fingers, and it's a certain type of pain, but it's a good pain. But I think that the majority of the pain that we experience in life isn't the good pain. It's often the bad pain, the pain that's brought on from disease and war. It's pain that's brought on by broken relationships in families and in our neighborhoods. It's brought on by racism and segregation in our city and in our neighborhoods. Well, this morning, the question that's posed for us is, where do we turn? What direction do we head in our moments of pain and desperation? Would you pray with me? Gracious Father, as we turn to your word this morning, we do come with heavy hearts, with minds that are busy thinking about the activities of the week, the burdens that we are carrying. And so, Father, I pray that your word would be spoken this morning in a way that comes across clearly, that comes across in a way that hits home for each one of us, in a way, Lord, that moves us to no longer flee to the things that only produce more pain in our life, but rather drives us to run after you and your chosen King. It's in your Son's name we pray. Amen. Well, we are in a series of 1 Samuel, and through the series of 1 Samuel, we've constantly been coming back to one particular contrast, the contrast between the King Saul and King David. King Saul, we will remember, is the king who, when the great giant warrior of Goliath taunted the people of Israel to send out a warrior, Saul hid behind the line of his army, while David was the one who ran out to fight him. You'll remember that Saul is the king who lost favor and lost the trust of his son Jonathan, while David was the king who earned the favor and trust of Jonathan. You also remember that Saul is the king who ended up abandoning God and turned his back on God and went about leading the people in his own way, while we know David is the king who strives to walk in the way of the Lord. Each one of these contrasts, as we've been reading through 1 Samuel, has brought out something new between these two kings. And this morning we come to a text that once again has another contrast, another comparison. And I believe what is unique about this comparison today is that we learn that King Saul is a king who leads in a way that produces only more pain and more desperation, while David is a king who leads in a way that provides protection for his people. The flow of our text today, it kind of forms a bit of a sandwich. We have at the very beginning, at the very end, a picture of how David leads. That's verses 1 through 5 and then verses 20 through 23. And then right sandwiched in the middle is a depiction of Saul and how he leads. That's verses 6 through 19. So the way that we're going to walk through this passage is we're just going to touch on the very beginning of the chapter and set the stage so we understand why it is there's this contrast. And then we'll take a majority of our time to look at how does Saul lead in verses 6 through 19. And then we'll return back to those two bookends, the two depictions of how David leads in verses 1 through 5 and 20 through 23. So to set the stage, we at the outset of our chapter, we find David finding refuge in some caves. He's on the run. He's actually found out that Saul, his father-in-law, has determined to kill him. And so he has fled to some caves. He's been actually seeking for a little bit, as we might remember from last week, that he's been trying to look for a place of refuge, and he finds it in some caves. Well, the word spread pretty quickly that David had found a place, a safe place to be. And so as at the beginning of our chapter, it says that his brothers and all his father's house heard it, and they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him. The people of Israel had fallen upon hard times. They were in a desperate state and in need of a new direction. And so as we find here, many of them turned to David. Well, you might recall the story of Steve Jobs and Apple, that great titan of a company who seems to run the world with its iPhones and iPads and iWatches and Macs. It's hard to imagine such a great company ever falling upon hard times, ever is struggling. But as you may recall, Steve Jobs helped start the company, but after a few years had a falling out between he and the board of directors, and so he ended up leaving Apple for a time. And so for a period of about 10 years, Steve Jobs and Apple had no relationship. And in those 10 years, the company began to flounder. It began to struggle. The stocks fell, and the company was on its last legs. So the board of directors had to swallow a little bit of their pride and eat maybe a few of their words that they had said and welcome back Steve Jobs. They were in a place of desperation and in need of a new direction. And so they asked Steve Jobs to come back, and it was his job to turn the ship around, to turn the company back on a track that they might succeed. And so he was able to set them on a trajectory that has led them to become the company that we know it as today. Desperation demands direction. That is the situation that we see the Israelites in today. They are in need of someone to come in and turn the ship around, to give them direction while they are in a space of pain and desperation. So the question before them is, will they follow a king who only produces more pain in their life? Or will they follow a king who can provide protection and a trajectory out of their pain and desperation? Well, let us turn to look at how Saul leads in verses 6 through 19. Saul, we will come to see here in verses 6 through 19, he leads in a way that rejects the people, betrays the people, and ultimately murders the people. In verses 6 through 19, we have actually two small pictures of them, two small pictures of how Saul leads. Verses 6 through 10 kind of recount the story of how Saul found out that David had fled from him before he was able to murder David. And then verses 11 through 19 recounts the story when Saul found out that a priest had helped David escape. And as I said, we'll come to see that Saul leads in a way that rejects the people, betrays the people, and ultimately murders them. Take a look at verse 7. 7 reads, "And Saul said to his servants who stood around him, 'Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he give you all, will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day.'" Well, David has turned and run from Saul. He has fled from Saul's presence because Saul had determined to kill David. You'll notice here that he references David as that son of Jesse. He no longer even associates David to him, even though David is his son-in-law. Saul has led in a way that has rejected his own family. And a king who is willing to reject his own family is a king who is willing to reject his own people. well, the people aren't only rejected, but they're also betrayed. There's some irony in these words that Saul uses to question the people, his servants. He asks them, you know, is David this great king who's going to make you commanders and will give you fields and vineyards? What's happening here is Saul's actually mocking the warning that Samuel had given the people about this choosing a king for themselves. Back in chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, when the people came to Samuel and said, we want a king. We no longer want to follow after God. We just want a king to be like the rest of the nations. Samuel came to them and warned them about what would happen when they chose a king for themselves. This is chapter 8, and this is the warning that Samuel gave to the people. These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots, and to be his horsemen, and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your male servants and female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your flock and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king whom you have chosen for yourself. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. Saul became that horrible king who took from the people their vineyards and their land, who took from them their children, who ended up making all things slaves to him and to his ways. And Saul here is mocking them. He's betrayed them. A king who was supposed to rule over them and protect them and help them prosper has now taken them as his slaves. Well, not only does Saul reject his people and betray his people, but he ultimately goes on to murder his people. We find out in that second little picture of Saul and his leadership that upon hearing that one of his priests had helped David escape, he went after him and he ordered him to be murdered. But you'll notice that none of his servants, Saul's servants, were willing to do that. The only one who was willing to do that is the Edomite. That is Doeg. You might have caught on that Doeg, this random character in this story, is the one who also betrays David. But it's always mentioned that he's this Edomite, that he's an outsider. He's not even an Israelite. He's the one who ultimately obeys Saul. In verse 18, it says that we read of the destruction that Saul orders for the priests. It reads, then the king said to Doeg, you turn and strike the priests. And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priests, and he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. And Noab, the city of priests, he put to the sword, both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep, he put to the sword. Saul is a horrible king. He not only rejects and betrays, but he murders his own people and priests. He has rejected God and his ways. Saul he's worse than just a friend who betrays you and talks behind your back. He's worse than a manager who betrays you and says and throws you under the bus for a problem that they created. Saul is as bad as a parent who abuses their child, a parent who's supposed to care for and take love and help the child flourish has betrayed their child when they abuse them. And that is what has happened here with Saul. He has betrayed his own people and has abused them. And it's hard to imagine how anyone would ever follow after a king so horrible as this. But I might be so bold this morning as to suggest that you and I, our hearts are inclined at times to follow after things and people who often lead us in directions that only cause us more pain and desperation. Think, for example, when we have stress in our life, we tend to believe the lie that alcohol will almost numb the pain or release the pain of the day, the stress of the day. Or many of us enter relationships we should in unhealthy relationships. We try to drown ourselves in sex and other relationships that only numb for a period of time, but ultimately lead to more pain and desperation. Working with college students, I find that one of the key things that they do to numb the pain of that they experience is by watching hour upon hour of Netflix. They numb themselves, but ultimately these directions that they turn in the moments of pain and desperation only lead to more pain and more desperation. This morning, we have to ask ourselves, where do we turn when we are feeling that pain and desperation? Are we prone as well to follow after such things as horrible as a king like Saul? Well, this morning, our text has a beautiful message for us. And that's that there is an alternative direction to turn in our desperation. There's an alternative way to go than to flee to these things that only lead to more pain and desperation. And we see that in the chosen king, the king that is depicted for us in David. So as we turn and look at verses 1 through 5 and also 20 through 23, these two bookends to our chapter, we form a picture of another king, a king who doesn't reject his people, but rather he gathers his people. A king who doesn't betray his people, but rather takes responsibility and command of his people. A king who doesn't murder his people, but rather protects and preserves them. As we turn to look at the beginning of our chapter, verses 1 and 2, we do find that the word has spread, that David has found a safe place. His brothers and his father's house heard, and so they went down to him. And then everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him. David is a king who gathers his people. These descriptions of these people who gathered to him are those who have come upon hard times. Those who are in distress. That word distress is often used in reference to a ship that has run aground or who has hit something and it's in a state of distress. We might say that ship is in a state of distress after it hit the coral reef. It's sinking. Those people whose lives are sinking, those are the people who gather to David. It goes on, it says, everyone who was in debt, that chain of debt, that burden of debt. Laura and I this week were setting up our plan to work on our student loans this past week. And as you think about how debt can add up and add up, and it can be at times that there doesn't seem to be a plan or a way out. It's a burden that weighs heavy and holds us back. It restrains us from moving forward. It's people who feel the weight of debt that are welcomed into the presence of David. It says also that it's everyone who is bitter in soul. That phrase is, I think too often I can relate to that phrase, that bitterness of soul. Well, we in the book of Samuel this is not the first time that we've heard this phrase used, bitterness of soul. You might remember the character Hannah, that is Samuel's mother. She was in chapter 1, we come across her in a state of bitterness of soul. Her husband was married to another man he was married to another woman who was able to bear children for him. And Hannah was unable to bear children. And that caused her to have bitterness of soul. In verse 10 of chapter 1, it reads, she was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. In the NIV, it's translated to see it a little more clearly in that it says that out of bitterness of soul, she prayed and wept. Bitterness of soul is brought on by the desire to have children and yet not being able to have any. Bitterness of soul is also brought on by even having a child, but a child whose health is not well. Bitterness of soul is brought on by a desire for a new job and yet not finding one. Bitterness of soul is something that comes upon us all too often and all too easily. But it's those who experience that bitterness of soul that's who's welcomed to David's presence and who gathered to him. But David isn't just a king who gathers his people. He's a king who also takes responsibility and command over his people. It continues in verse 2 and says, and he became commander over them, and there were with him about 400 men. In our states of pain and desperation, it seems that the darkness is too dark, that it doesn't seem to be a path or a bridge out. And we just wish that someone would come in and provide that way out, that would provide that bridge or that path out. That's what we see in David. When he takes responsibility, he takes command. Instead of betraying his people and leaving them to their desperation, he gives them a plan. When the prophet God comes to him and tells him to return to Judah, so they're not even in their homeland anymore. When the prophet tells them to return, David boldly steps forward and leads the people back into their homes, back out of their place of desperation, into that country where David's life is actually, this king of that country wants him to be murdered. He leads with boldness and he leads his people out of their state of pain and desperation. But thirdly, we see that he's not a king who murders his people, but rather he protects and preserves their life. In verses 20 through 23, that the last depiction of him, we see that Abiathar, the priest who got away from Doeg and his mass destruction of the city of Nob, he flees to David. And upon his arrival to David, David says to him, "Stay with me, do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me you shall be in safekeeping." David is a king who doesn't reject his people. He's a king who gathers them. He's a king who doesn't betray. He actually takes responsibility and commands them. He's a king who doesn't murder them, but preserves them and keeps them in safekeeping. Well, as I've suggested this morning, that David is the king that the Israelites should flee to. He's the one who will not lead to more pain, but will lead to protection. David is God's chosen king, but he's only but a shadow of the great chosen king that comes to us in Christ, who, as Christ, he does a far greater job at gathering his people. He does a far greater job at taking control and command and giving us direction. He does a far greater job at preserving and protecting us. In Matthew chapter 11, Jesus once said, this is verse 28, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." He calls all of those who are in distress to come to him. He is able to call all of those, not just the Israelites, but all people to himself. He calls those who feel the weight of debt, that burden that's so heavy to bear. He calls them to take on his yoke, which he says is light. But he also says that he can replace that bitterness of soul and he can place it with rest. That is the chosen king's responsibility. He comes as one who provides and protects. Well, the irony of chapter 22 of 1 Samuel is that the desperation, the pain that the people were in was brought on by themselves. They were the ones who didn't heed the warning of Samuel when he said to not abandon God, but they did. They abandoned God and chose a king for themselves who brought them to a place of pain and desperation. The irony is that their place of pain was brought on by themselves, and they were the ones who rejected God. And yet the beauty of the passage is that even those who reject God, reject God's chosen king, are the ones who are welcomed back into his presence. Those are the ones he calls to gather to him. Well, this morning, as we think about his faithfulness, we are reminded that our king is more faithful than a sibling to a brother who has gone wayward. He's more faithful than a wife to a cheating husband. He has chosen to deal with his people in an amazing way. He calls us that in our space of desperation and pain, he calls us to flee to him, that there is no other direction to go, and that he is the one who can provide a way out, a direction to go. And so this morning, the call for you is to flee to the king. Flee to the king in worship, flee to the king in prayer, flee to the king when you gather in the space together and as we break bread later today. Over this next couple months, as we head towards Easter, our pastors and our elders have put together a booklet that's called The Journey to Easter, and you can pick one up on your way out. This is another way that our pastors and our elders are trying to help us flee to the King as we run to him, as we lay down before him our distress, our debt, and our bitterness of soul. Allow him to be the one who replaces it with rest. So this morning, flee to the king, that you might hear him say to you, stay with me, do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me you shall be in safekeeping. For your king isn't a king who just makes promises, but he's a king who has laid down his life for you. He's not a king who will murder, but rather he's a king who's willing to protect you to the point where he's murdered, so that you might have the ability to flee to him. Would you pray with me?